A new documentary is now streaming about the rise and fall of the baseball Negro Leagues. It's part sports, part business, belonging, and the long chase for civil rights. It's called The League, featuring interviews with players, risk-taking entrepreneurs, historians, poets, including one Maya Angelou.
The story is about the American Negro Baseball League, where always good news. People say, did you hear about the league? And you always knew that they meant the Negro Baseball League.
Sam Pollard is director of the league, and he joins us now. Sam, thanks for being here.
It's my pleasure. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Your film traces a century or so of African Americans in baseball, often intersecting with key moments in civil rights history. 1896 is the year of Plessy versus Ferguson, the case enshrining segregation in American society, which brought about the separate Negro baseball leagues. Let's pick up with historian Lawrence Hogan in your film.
After the Plessy versus Ferguson decision, great black professional baseball teams come into being. And the players and the games were ballyhooed by newspapers that were their own newspapers. And those newspapers knew the audience that they had to play to.
Sam, so the Negro Leagues rose as the African-American economy formed and grew on the other side of the curtain, as it were. Is that one way to think about this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to understand that they were part of this economic engine in these segregated communities. There were stores, there were funeral parlors, and there were Negro League owners who had their own franchises. So this was not just about entertaining the community, but it was about economic survival and economic ownership. These gentlemen and ladies were entrepreneurs.
One player and entrepreneur I want to ask you about, Rube Foster. On the field, he was a star pitcher. You tell the story of how he helped develop the screwball and was brought in secretly to teach it to the White Hall of Fame pitcher, Christy Mathewson. As far as his contribution to the Negro Leagues, what was it?
Well, here's the thing to remember. He became an owner of a team, the Chicago American Giants. And then in 1920, he felt that Negro League owners should come together, band together, and create their own Negro National League. The next year, there was the Colored League that was created. And these two leagues played against each other in the 1924 World Series. And this was really the beginning of organized Negro League baseball. Sadly, Rube Foster passed away around 1930, and the league sort of suffered. But in the 30s in Pittsburgh, two other men, they revived the Negro Leagues. Tom Posey, who owned the Homestead Graves, and Gus Greenlee, who owned the Pittsburgh Crawfords. And that was sort of really another big major heyday where you saw the names that a lot of us are familiar with. Satchel Paige, Josh Gibson, Cool Papa Bell, yeah. Oscar Charleston.
Let's talk about Satchel Paige. His name, as the story goes, comes from him working at a train station growing up, toting people's bags or satchels. And you have some previously unreleased video of Satchel Paige.
It was hard to beat, man. You couldn't hardly beat me. I did some things in baseball I've never seen anyone else do. I didn't know what I was doing one half of the time, but still I did it.
He was so great. Legend has it that in one game he called in the outfield. He had them sit behind him with the infield as he struck out three batters with nine pitches. That's how great he was as a pitcher.
He just and said, don't even play the field. Just stand behind me as I do all the work.
Just stand behind me and I'll do all the rest. And he was able to, even at the age of 42, you know, he played in the major leagues. He was one of the first African-Americans besides Jackie Robinson and Larry Doby to play for a major league team, the Cleveland Indians.
There are the players. There are the owners. And one voice is the co-owner of the Newark Eagles, a woman, Effa Manley, who owns the team along with her husband, Abe Manley. And she not only helps to manage a team that does really well, on the civil rights front, she takes on the owners of a department store in Harlem.
Yeah, here she was. I mean, and there's the controversy about was she a black woman, was she a white woman? But she grew up in a black community. When Bloomstein's, a very well-known department store, was in Harlem, and the owners had only white clerks, she demanded that they should hire black women clerks for the store. She made such a strong case for it that those white owners finally relented and hired black female clerks for Bloomstein, you know, which was a major store in Harlem. I remember going to Bloomstein's when I was a teenager. And then she went on to lead the Newark Eagles to winning the 1946 Negro League World Series against the Kansas City Monarchs. But her other big, you know, claim to fame, as far as I'm concerned, was, and we didn't know this when we were doing the film, that Branch Rickey, who's mythologized as this great savior who brought Jackie Robinson to the Brooklyn Dodgers, did not compensate the Negro League owners for signing Jackie Robinson, for signing Don Newcomb, for signing Roy Campanella. And she publicly made it known in the press that Branch didn't want to compensate these Negro League owners, including herself.
I never felt he was right to take those valuable players and not give us a nickel for them. I felt that was very wrong. And we should have had some little compensation, but we were in no position to protest, and he knew it. So he just completely outmaneuvered us, outsmarted us, or just plain raped us. I don't know what you'd say, how you'd describe it.
And she was able, though, to get Bill Veeck, who was running the Cleveland Indians, to compensate her for the services of Larry Doby, who became the first African-American player to play in the American League.
That's really part of the essence of the cost of baseball integration. And in other leagues, you buy a player and you pay for the player. In this case, it starts to hollow out the Negro Leagues, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, fans no longer went to Negro League games because now many of their major stars in their cities, you know, Jackie Robinson, Willie Mays, Hank Aaron, Ernie Banks, Monty Irvin, Larry Doby, they were playing in Major League Baseball. So black fans started to go see them play in the Major League ballparks, which made the Negro League team suffer. So by the 50s, you know, they were barely hanging on. And by 1960, the Negro Leagues were gone.
Do you think if these teams in the Negro Leagues got even partially paid what their star players were worth, they could have continued on? They had a proven product.
I think what could have happened is that the major leagues could have seen the Negro Leagues as sort of a minor league extension and could have said, we want to keep you guys in our fold to find Negro League players and compensate these Negro League owners. But they decided not to do it.
Yeah. You know, what I found instructive watching your documentary was learning more about the life of the players as they traveled during Jim Crow. In some cases, they had to sleep in buses, even in ballparks. And what's fascinating is when some of them went to the Caribbean for winter ball.
Players Max Manning and Monty Irvin of the Newark Eagles,
they described the freedom of being black men there.
When you are out of your own country and you find everything so much better, you know, it's a revelation in a way if you never experienced it. But it's like heaven, you know, I want to go back, you know, I got to go back there.
There was very little discrimination, so you felt, you know, free. The fact that, you were accepted for your ability, not from the color of your skin, and that really made you feel great.
And here's cultural critic Gerald Early and Negro League scholar Larry Lester on the early international flavor of America's pastime.
In some ways, baseball generated a kind of diaspora.
Negro Leagues was a rainbow coalition of players of color. Everything from chalk to charcoal. That was the pigmentation that played in the Negro Leagues.
Well, you know, this is always a tragedy of the African-American experience. You know, we struggle with being treated as second-class citizens in America, and we go off as baseball players to play in Mexico or play in Venezuela or play in the Dominican Republic, and we're welcomed with open arms. We go off to fight in World War II, you know, and we're more accepted than we are in our own country. The notion that a black man could go to the Caribbean and play baseball without feeling the same kind of pressure and psychological baggage that you had to deal with in America had to be something that was emotionally and psychologically invigorating.
For listeners who, you know, may already know a little bit about the Negro Leagues or someone who thinks he or she does, why are you inviting that person to watch a documentary? I mean, what fresh questions or observations do you think it delivers?
I think simply this. I think it's another opportunity for Americans, all Americans, to understand that American history is not just white history. You know, it's a history that involves people of color, Native people, African-American people, who are part and parcel, you know, were part of shaping the direction of this country for good or for bad. And I just think that, you know, when I make these films, I want people to know that our stories are part of the American story.
Sam Pollard is director of The League, and we've got pictures and links at our website, hereandnow.org. Sam, congratulations on this film, and thanks so much for the time.
My pleasure.
Satchel Paige's mellow, so is Campanella. Newcomb and Dobie too. But it's a natural fact, when Jackie comes to bat, the other team is through.
Did you see Jackie Robinson hit that ball?